I'm an economist. I teach at the University of Maryland. I'm really interested in how societies develop over time, particularly interested in relationships between political and economic development. And as I talked quite a bit about yesterday, things tend to go those two things go together. So if we want to explain the process of modern development, we need to understand both how politics and economics go together. I'm really interested, when I was at Holden,
I was back in Holden, back in 1960s, you know.
And I was interested in poverty, you know, and I was, as you know, when you're young, you think, I'm going to do something really good with my life. When you get old, you think, wow, what did I do? So I was interested in doing something bad, but I was really interested in poverty, and I was interested in being an economist, but that put some things together over time, and what a leap, you know, there's kind of, I can take money out of my pocket and give it to a poor person, that redistributes income, but over time, in history, and I did this yesterday, we think of this as time, and this is income, of course, I don't write things for those people can't reach them. Income basically was flat, it actually has some squiggles, sometime around 1800 or so. In the modern world, it went like that. So we're talking about poverty and wealth, how we change it, and we could go, you know,
more difficult for a rich man to get into heaven than for the criminal to go through the eye of an eagle.
Stuff like that. You know, we can read the Magnificat about how these, you know, all these mighty have fallen and all that kind of jazz. So the rich have always been with us, as well as the poor. But in terms of the wealth that we've experienced in our society, this is a very recent phenomenon. And of course, there's lots of, in fact, most of the world's population lives in countries that are still, or in societies that are still relatively poor. So if you're really serious about eliminating poverty, you're not about giving money to poor people. Or at least in my world, how do we get societies to develop better? Okay, and that's really important. It turns out that that's not just about how much food you have to eat or how much money you have. That turns out to be about your civil rights and your political system and your ability to express yourself and your ability to go be free to go where you want. Because those things all turn out to go together. So that's kind of the question I'm trying to get at, and I've been working on this for actually most of my life now. Yesterday we talked about the problem of how do you measure wealth. That's kind of what we started with. Talked about the question of corn. What's this? You know, no sparrow falls the head of every hare kind of thing. And God knows all that stuff, but man, think about counting all the ears of corn. Take you forever. Forever. I mean, literally, you wouldn't get this year's crop counted before next crop was growing. There's just too much stuff. So we talked about how a little bit how we think about income, what gross national product. A little bit these kind of measures of wealth are, where they come from, and then there's a more difficult problem. How do societies work? Yeah. There's 300 million Americans. The census tries to count them every 10 years. That's a big problem. But how do they all fit together? How do these societies actually work? That's a really, you know, there's, 5 billion people in the world? How does this whole thing fit together? Hard question. Okay? Now, there's lots of different branches of this, but basically, the kind of shared beliefs that we have, or ideas about how society works, what do we call that? You know? History. I know if anybody were at Jody's session yesterday afternoon, they had this assets that communities possess, and the last one was their stories. Now, their history, their identity, their stories of who they are, who they think they are. Now, it's really hard to learn about the world, so we learn about the world through our direct experience, the things that we actually experience. And we're all pretty good and agreed about gravity, you know, because we all have this really common experience. And we all have some common histories, right? Big Lutheran thing. Not all of us Lutheran, but we have this common kind of things that we do. And I always thought, you know, when I was growing up, and as I was getting older, that history was true. You know, history was how I learned about how the world worked. Then I started writing it. There were some problems there, you know, with that kind of process. And
So the way I kind of think about this is that we've got things that happen in the world that we try to verify, that we can, you know, reasonable people can think about this actually happened. We could call that a fact, and I'm not really sure that that's what we want to call it. I'm going to call it a dot. Okay, rather than a fact, I don't want to load this dot thing up with too much minute. Mostly what I talked about yesterday was dot formation. How do we actually, so they talked about how income was different across the different parts of the world. How actually do we think about that? What's the process we do? Where did that number come from? And one of the things that I pointed out yesterday that was really important is to understand that one of the reasons that, you know, four countries are poor, that are down here instead of up here, is that when we look at their economic performance over time, they're as likely to go backwards as they are to go forward. You know, so that's something that if we don't grasp that, then we're missing something important about the dynamics of those societies. But in fact, you know, have you ever done those word search games? You know, you get just a bunch of letters, and then you're supposed to find the words and circle them. You know, we could have stories, circles, connecting the dots. Okay, now, one of the really interesting things is that some stories, you could take the same set of dots, get this set of stories, and get that set of stories. Okay, so what do we call a circle, a story without any dots in it?
Faith.
Faith is evidence of belief in evidence. What is it? Does Luther say what faith is? It is evidence. Belief. Faith. It's belief in things you can't see. It's belief in things you can't know. The Bible study this morning, you know, Sonia's there. She's a doubter. She's a doubter. She should be a doubter because you're not supposed to have dots in this faith stuff. You need dots. It's not faith. That's kind of belief. Right?
You're waiting for us to debate with you, aren't you?
No, I'm not. I want you to think about it. I want you to think about how often this week, when you're here at Holden Village, we're going to tell ourselves that we know something. In fact, what I took away from that Bible study this morning, keep one of those miracle stories, is we cannot know what's going on. We think we got this sucker nailed. I read this, and I understand the logic of why Christ died for me. That is an empty circle. Now, many of the things that we think are true, that we think are dots, are really circles. Okay? That is, there are ways that we pull together the things that we learn. And in fact, we have beliefs about the way the world works. Yeah, we don't think of it as faith and religion, but in fact, our notions of how the world functions around us, we cannot help but have ideas like that. Okay, if we didn't, we would be dogs or bears, or even worse, insects. Insects, Phoebus here, right? They don't have circles. We have streams of dots. Okay, in fact, we can construct these abstractions. Now, early on in my life, one of my favorite teachers of all I've learned, I had social science with when in my freshman year in high school, he talked about frames of reference. And he was talking about it and thinking about, you know, how do I interpret what other people say? Remember yesterday I talked about how I'm really not a teacher. Okay? I'm a researcher. And so I'm thinking about stuff. And I used that yesterday to say, I know that sometimes I skip steps because I'm most interested in what I thought about this week. And so if you have any questions, please ask me. But one of the things I'm really interested in is changing the way we think from this way to this way. Okay? Because I think we've been missing our explanations for this problem all along. That the way we think about how societies work has been dramatically affected by
everybody from Aristotle, Polybius, Machiavelli, James Madison, and Alexander Hamilton, the Federalist Papers, Montesquieu, you name it, about how this world worked. But we live in this world. We use their ideas to describe our world. But our world works on a different logic. The logic of societies that don't grow very much over time is different. And so we don't want to use the James Madison, Alexander Hamilton circles. We need to get some different circles. And so part of what I want to talk to you about today, in fact, virtually all of what I want to talk to you about today, is about the problem of violence and social orders, which is a title of a book I'm writing, colon, A Conceptual Framework for Interpreting Recorded Human History. That's the subtitle of the book.
Yeah, it's a modest little title. Oh, I'm not going to explain all of history. I'm just going to explain the last 10,000 years.
Well, I bet you limited.
But we're good. And so today I want to talk about sort of ways of thinking about how societies work and go that will hopefully begin to get at something about this kind of problem. Why is it that societies, many societies, don't grow over very long periods of time, or that they tend to go backwards instead of forwards? Why is that? And how do societies develop to go forward more? So that's the kind of thing that I want to talk about. By the way, you know, there's this. Okay. So until about 10,000 years ago, the typical human society was how many people? Do we know?
You mean globally, or you mean in some local?
Well, not the population. There's the population. But we don't think of today as our population, the 5 billion, as being the size of human society. Because we think of the world is made up of human societies, right, groups, and we can think about different kinds of groups, national groups, community groups.
25.
Okay, the modal sized human unit is about 25 people. Anthropologists call these bands. About 25, and they might occasionally appear in tribes. Get up to 200 or so. Or if you know about the Kwaki, the Indians in Seattle, they're called a big man society. They have one kind of big leader who's kind of the first among equals, and they might get to 500. Very few societies get significantly bigger than 200 to 500. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the typical unit, the social unit, is 25. There's a bunch of research lately, this is a highly contested issue in anthropology, that suggests that societies that are made up of units of 25 are really violent. I have a friend who does what's called anthropometrics. He convinced these anthropologists, it's the measure of man, literally the physical measure. Anthropologists all have their own skeletons, the physical anthropologists, and they talk to one another, but they don't compare very well. So they got 12,000 New World skeletons, North and South America. And about 3,000 of the skeletons, they actually figured out where people lived. And then you can see what happened to the rate of human-induced violence, because, you know, did you have an arrow sticking in you? You know, did you get injuries to your head or your arms, which tend to be, you know, there's certain kinds of forensic medicine kinds of issues. And the evidence seems pretty clear that hunting and gathering societies are really violent. They exhibit about three times the rate of human-induced violence that village and towns do. And this was even true before Columbus came to America. Why? Why do you live? Why? Surviving. Why do you live in groups of 25?
Scarcity.
No, because there can be lots of groups of 25 competing for resources. There is some issues there about if you're foraging and gathering, what the optimal size group is. In a bigger group, you know, you exhaust some resources around you quicker.
Communication, collaboration.
Yeah.
Smaller groups.
It's easier to.
Is there a critical mass point, you know, where you want to have enough people that you can have some people look after the kids and some people be hunting and gathering? But if you get to be too big, you'll go through your resources too much and you'll get hungry?
Well, there's that point. There's a kind of resource point. But if you think about specialization and division of labor, it's clearly you want to be bigger. Because the bigger you are, the more jobs, more specialized you can do, and you can become much more productive.
Too many dominant individuals?
No. Well, yeah, that could be a problem. In fact, all these societies tend to be extremely aggressively egalitarian. So they have leaders, but when the leaders get too big for their britches, they kill them. Well, they don't kill them, they, because the leaders realize that's what's going to happen. So what's the problem with dominant individuals? Okay, say you live in a world where there's lots of violence. How can you guard against that?
How many people you can watch at one time?
Yeah, how many people can you actually know? Okay?
I don't know. I'm very lucky. I did not. Nobody in my family is abusive or regularly violent, but I know people who are. And I used to, like, I was in high school, I had a really close friend who was a hockey player. Used to like to fight. There's some people at Holden over the years who just like to fight. We had a guy who used to cut down trees and chop wood. I mean, he was a lumberjack. He was a huge guy. He was big, enormous shoulders. He would go out and get drunk and go get into fights because he liked it. He was scary. Okay? Now, how? But what happened was you could deal with him if you knew him. Right? And you had to kind of not just know him like, hi. You had to know him like, I understand what's going on here. It's time for me to leave. Well, how many people can you really, really know?
24.
somewhere in this size range are the people that you can actually know face to face. And if you live in a world where knowing people face to face is really important, and you come across somebody you don't know and you think there might be violence, what's the optimal strategy? Shoot first. Okay? Throw the rock first or into the air or whatever. If you're worried about violence and being perpetrated upon you, the best way to respond to that is, in fact, to be violent first, because there's a big advantage. And that becomes what economists would call an equilibrium, or game theorists would call a strategy. Right? That if you're in a world where everybody is potentially violent, then everybody is the best assumption is to assume that other people are going to be violent. Then small groups work because you got to know the people well enough not to be violent. You might have tribes that come together once or twice a year. They can't live together in close proximity because they don't know each other, but they can all have some sort of sign. They can have a tattoo on their forehead. They can wear some kind of clothes. They can do something so that they can get together. What do they do when they get together? Sex. Why? Inbreeding. So they need exogamy. That is, if you have this small of groups, you can't continue to breed. So you need some way to bring in. So either women move or men move, typically, right? And depending on whether you're matriarchal or patriarchal and how you put these things together. So you have societies which have slightly larger units which are temporary. So this is a society with a high level of violence and very small units. We would call this, in our framework, a foraging order. We used to call it a primitive order, but then people got really upset.
We mean they're primitive. They're not primitive.
They're virtuous. You know, there's a big debate in anthropology now about these guys, about whether small societies are more or less violent. Because there are these notions that, primitive man was really peaceful. Then they find out that they're building all these walls. Why? Why would you build walls if you're peaceful? I mean, the walls are, one of the first places that archaeologically is Jericho. What distinguishes Jericho? The walls and the thickness, and the Jews go around with the horns and the walls come tumbling down. They built those places not because they liked walls. They built really thick walls because they were great to get behind. Okay? So now the question is, how do we get from societies of 25, which until about 10,000 years ago we know that there were no societies that were really larger than maybe a couple hundred. Because when 1,000 people live together in close proximity for any period of time, they leave really strong evidences of it. Right? I mean, 10,000 years from now, 50,000 years from now, Holden Village, even if there's no Lutheran camp here, there will be physical evidence, the tailings, obviously, that people were here. Okay? And so we don't find those. The anthropologists and archaeologists don't find this. And they do find, you know, sites of human habitation from 200,000 years ago where a band of 20 people camped by the riverside for a season. And so, I mean, it's not that they don't have the findings to do this. So, and how do we do this? Well, let's suppose we got groups of 25, and I'm going to tell you the story really simply to start, and then I'm going to make it more complicated. The complicated story is more realistic about how this actually works, but the simple story will get you to the essence. So let's say we've got two groups of 25 or, you know, so in this room, and they're fighting a lot. And the two strongest guys are Mark and Chris. You know, I know. He's a theologian, you know.
That's really just.
What? Yeah, plays nose. Yeah, played nose guard. And this guy brews beer.
He stokes his fire, his finger.
Okay, so. So they're the guys we have to worry about. Of course, in the small groups, you guys can, you know, the group can control them. So they're kind of big men. You know, they're first among equals kind of people. And but of course, who's the biggest threats to Chris? Mark. And who's the biggest threat to Mark? Chris. Now, you all collectively are threats to both of them. Okay, and they have this problem, which is they have to sleep. Okay. So the kind of stylized solution to this problem of violence between and within the bands are Mark and Chris get together. Now, the problem if Mark and Chris get together and decide not to fight or to try to coalesce together, as soon as Chris puts down his rock, what does Mark do? He kills him. So it's not, you know, there's this hit first equilibrium kind of thing. That's what's rational to do. It's not rational for either of them to put down their arms. Okay, which means that violence is a continuous outcome. They're always really a threat. So the solution we're going to propose here is right down the line of the microphones. I'm sorry, you're going to be split in half. Is that Chris and Mark make an arrangement in which everything on this side of the room belongs to Mark. All the land, the labor, the capital, all the people, everything. And on this side of the room, everything belongs to Chris. And there's two of them, so they can one can be up, you know, they can all both be up 18 hours a day, and one's up while the other sleeps. And together, if they work together, and they both have rocks and arms, it's really difficult for you guys to overwhelm them. If you all collectively did, that would work, right? But that means you guys all have to coordinate. Which is really hard because some of you don't like each other and some of you don't know each other because there's, you know, two big groups here. And you know, if you're in a place like the Soviet Union or you're talking about Iran and you stand up to protest, but who dies? Oh, the first guy to stand up. He's a leader. Go him. Right? So they're going to be looking for you. They're looking for you. Now, the thing here is that they get everything you produce. And what happens if you fight, if they fight, to what you produce? Ever been around a war? Output goes way down really fast when violence breaks up. Because instead of planting your crops and gathering berries and all that sort of stuff, you immediately start trying to defend yourself. Okay? So your output goes down, physical output of goods and services, because most of what you're investing in is now defense. If your output goes down, what happens to their income? It goes down. Now, can anybody see how that might enable Mark and Chris to trust each other? Yeah. If the loss from them fighting is large enough, it may be that neither Chris or Mark can see enough gain from killing the other one to be greater than the loss of your output while they fight. Now, it turns out that just opening that wedge is increasing the cost of fighting, or increasing the benefits of peace, if you will, may be enough to get them to credibly trust one another. They don't trust you, but they can credibly trust one another. Remember yesterday I talked about the concept of rents? You're willing to buy a pound of apple for $2, and for $10 and you only had to pay $2, you got an $8 rent, right? And that's interesting because if you value apples at $2 a pound and you go to the store and they go up from $2 to $2.01, you don't buy the apples. You're indifferent. You've got all kinds of good alternatives. Okay? But if you got a $10 rent and the price of apples goes up and down, you still buy the apples. Okay? Now, but looking around, I see that most of you are in my position, which is that you have a job which you're heavily invested in and your next best alternative is making about a fifth of what you're making, or you're retired. As you get older, because you get invested in your job, you get more rents from your job, because what you could do outside gets worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. Okay? So the University of Maryland could lower my salary a bit, I get really mad, They might threaten to quit, but in fact, I don't have another job out there. Whereas if I'm working at McDonald's for minimum wage and my boss screws around with me, I'm getting zero rent from that job, so it's easy for me to move. Mark and Chris are getting rents from peace. And they only get those rents, the increase in your output, if they don't fight. So they're not going to, you know, small little tiny changes here aren't going to upset their behavior because they're getting this big payment. Now, I said this was very unrealistic, and it is, because Mark and Chris are not going to be able to enjoy your output easily. Okay? So what they really need is a Lutheran minister. I know that I'm talking about now about three quarters of the crowd. You're either Lutheran ministers or spouses of Lutheran ministers, right? What do they need? They need a church. What's the church for? They need a religion. They need a religion which says, bring your grain into the temple at harvest time. We are a unified society. We care for one another. We believe in reciprocity. We believe in brotherhood. We believe in goodness. We believe in eternal damnation if you don't follow these rules. And the priests not only provide a belief system in which they might be extra special, but they perform a way for gathering economic resources, which are then available for them to enjoy. Now, this means in some years when there's a drought that they don't get anything extra because they are, in fact, committed to feeding you. Yeah. They have property rights in you. They own you in some sense. But they have, by getting a religious elite, what's your name?
Leo.
Leo and?
Nathan.
Nathan. Leo and Nathan are the priests. You know, they can have the kind of funny little things to wear and stuff. And
well, they have robes and they chant and Kyrie, like,
you know, they do that stuff. Okay, and you, okay. So they can, in fact, form a mechanism. Now, of course, there's going to have to be, that when they become priests, what happens to their income and their well-being? It goes up, but only if these two jokers stay in power. Right, so they have a really strong interest to cooperate with them. Your teacher, Tom.
Yeah.
And Aaron. Mm-hmm. These guys get to be the trade ministers. Because once we get peace, Mark and Chris want to encourage the different sides of the room to trade with one another. Because you get a bigger, you get more specialization in division of labor. Okay. You get some people specializing in childcare. You get some people specializing in growing wheat. Some people specializing in growing wine or making beer. Those different kinds of things. And you can get more output with the same amount of resources, inputs, land, labor, capital, if there's more specialization in division of labor. But what happens is along this divide, down the middle of the room, you got to go through Tom or Aaron. So what happens to Tom and Aaron's income? It goes up. It's a rent they're getting. And, of course, that gives them strong incentives to support Mark and Chris and Leo and Nathan. Right? Now, if everybody can trade, if you can buy and sell wheat and wine, whatever you want to everybody, what happens to the rents that Tom and Aaron get?
Go down.
They go to zero. And what happens to their incentives to cooperate in this coalition? Okay? So, one way we can call this is a limited access order. And we use the word, because this is what we started out with, we call this a natural state. We call this a Mark Chris world, in which a relatively small percentage of the population limits access to valuable social functions like religion, like trade, like fighting, like education. And because they limit access, they make rents. That is, they make a return above and beyond their alternative. And those rents, which only exist if that coalition exists, create incentives for all six of them to be on the same page. What happens to the size of the society? It goes up. This is a solution to the problem of violence. Now, does it eliminate violence? No way. Because who's Chris still most worried about?
Mark.
And who's Mark most worried about?
Chris.
And they're all kind of worried about Tom. Okay? He's got, where's your stick? But you laughed it. He's usually got this stick.
It's getting better.
It's getting better. Okay, good. Right? In other words, the problem of this coalition of people, of leaders, there it is. Yeah. Right? They're all worried about each other. They are. They're kind of worried about you guys. And I'm sorry, you peons, or, you know, I am too, so I'm, you know. The peasants, the serfs, the whatever, the kulaks, you name, you know, get your word from history, for all the people who really don't have rights. Now, that's an extreme version of this. I'll talk in a little bit about why it's not completely true. Because, in fact, are you worse or better off? Yeah, how many think worse? How many think better? We got both going on here, right? What are you not subject to? As much violence, okay? You're more productive in some way. And, of course, given the primitive technology, it's not clear that they're going to be able to expropriate everything that you produce. Okay, so you live in a society which is better ordered. The evidence on this seems to be, I think is fairly persuasive, although the anthropologists debate about this, that when you move from bands and tribes to chiefdoms, you move to societies of about 1,000 people or more, and all of a sudden you get hierarchy. You get a group of people at the top. They're almost always a coalition of people with military, economic, and religious privileges. They're privileged. Okay. And they're privileged because they're part of this coalition, part of this group, okay, that enjoy limited access. They're the people who have access to these functions, and other people don't have access to that. So you begin to get hierarchical societies. There's lots of explanations for this, obviously, in both the historical and anthropological literature. These societies tend to be less violent, kind of on the day-to-day basis, but they get bigger. So, of course, you have this problem of potentially enormous violence when bigger societies collide. World War II, think World War II, you know, 15 million dead. So there are problems with it. It does not eliminate violence. It provides a way to manage and control it. Now, does that mean that you guys are forever and ever out of the coalition, out of the elites? No, no. Don there, Don is a smart, mean guy. And if he starts organizing people and starts, you know, taking from the church treasury or, you know, interrupting the trade patterns, and he's powerful enough, what do these guys do? They co-opt him. They bring him into the coalition. This is not a closed access society. This is a limited access society. Anybody who shows up and turns out to be scary and powerful or really smart gets included in the deal. Some guy had been in Africa. He didn't tell me which country. He was a development economist from France. He said he was meeting with the president of the fishermen's union. He was organizing fishermen. It's on the west coast of Africa. And he said they were having a meeting. He was there with them, and the president of the country showed up. President of the whole country showed up in a limo. It's out of the limo, goes up to the president of the fishermen's union and says, "I want to talk to you." Yeah. President of the fishermen's union becomes part of the dominant coalition. Okay, the union itself becomes part of the structure of this society. Okay. Now, these are tricky societies because people do not enjoy full rights. They do not enjoy full participation. They do enjoy some protection, but they're, you know, the protection that the masses enjoy is limited compared to the protection that the coalition enjoys. Most of the time when violence breaks out, it's between coalition members, not between the masses and the elites. Although sometimes a leader will emerge that organizes the masses and they overthrow. Guess what happens historically when they do that? What do they end up with? Same thing. I mean, if you read history, you realize that popular movements do not result in democracy, civil rights, and equality. Think about what Kit was telling us last time about China in the 20th century. A bunch of revolutions that ended up with a small coterie of people, Dallas Gang of Four. Okay. Well, Latin American revolutions where they take all the land away from the rich people and redistribute to the poor people, and 10 years later, there's a small group of rich people who control all the land. Why? Now, why? Because that's a solution to the problem of violence. If you don't do that, and you get anarchy, everybody's worse off. We live in a society in which we really are taught to think that violence is an aberration. It's not. It's in the chimps, in the gorillas, in human beings. The potential for being violent. And societies that don't develop arrangements to limit that are subject to violence. And so when violence breaks out, and it gets beyond the bounds of the control that the social structure, in our case, the police and military can do. So it's a place like Chad, Rwanda. Kit was talking yesterday about how China in the 1950s developed warlords. Okay, what the warlords were people who controlled different geographic areas. In Afghanistan today, there's like 8 cities, one of Kabul's in the middle, and 7 of them are on the trade routes. And every trade route city has a warlord. And the problem with Afghanistan is that they collect taxes, but the warlords take all the money. And they don't ship it to the center. Well, the reason they don't ship it to the center is the center doesn't have anything to offer these warlords. And you want a warlord, because if you don't have a warlord, what do you get?
Violence.
Okay? So you're better off with a warlord. You know, you've heard stories about Chad or Rwanda or places Sudan, places where that we call these sort of dysfunctional states, where violence is just totally everywhere. People don't say, let's write a constitution, which is, I think, what we're trying to do in Iraq. But, right? So you have societies that live in the shadow of violence in a way that our society does not. And the solution to that violence, the natural solution to that violence, is a limited access order. Now, you can say, where's the dots? Show me the dots. Show me all the evidence. And we could spend some time doing that. But at the moment, I'm saying, this is just a really neat idea. We talk about history. We can talk about the dots. And I have enormous advantage in that because I've been thinking about this for 5 years. Of all the histories. Right? But the point there is not to think this is a society in which the political system manipulated. Manipulates the economy, that is, it creates these privileges. In order to manage the problem of violence. That's the logic of this kind of social order. That the political system manipulates economic privilege to control the problem of violence. I don't know if you've heard of the Communist Manifesto. The first sentence is there has always been in all human societies elites who steal from others. That is, all societies create economic privileges. Marx and Engels say this is wrong. Marx and Engels don't have much about violence in their story. In fact, when we think about the society, if you think about feudalism, if you think about the Ottoman Empire, if you think about the Chinese empires, what happens is, these guys are violent, okay, and they appear to be controlling because they have, in Max Weber's terms, a monopoly on violence. Right? Therefore, they're the state. But who are Marx and Chris really worried about? Themselves. Okay? They don't have a Chris doesn't have a monopoly on violence. Marx doesn't have a monopoly on violence.
And that's good.
That's good. In fact, that's part of their threats to each other, part of what makes this thing work. Right? Believe me, if you lived in Kenya this winter, you knew who your friends were. I have a friend, his name is Steve Webb. Actually, he's a co-author of one of the papers I've been writing this. He works at the World Bank. His son's name is Alan Webb. Those of you who follow track and field, he's a miler. He was the first high schooler to run a 4-minute mile since Jim Ryan back in the 1960s. Unfortunately, he did not make the Olympic team. He had a bad day at the trials in Eugene. Alan has lots of friends who are runners, and most of the best runners in the world come from Kenya and Ethiopia. And a good friend of his was from Kenya, who came, who is in the United States, living in the United States, and when the violence broke out, went back to Kenya and had to be secreted out of the country. Because his friends said to them, you're with us, or you're with them. And there's not a neutral position there. So he was actually witness the murder, and he had to get out. Because you don't have a choice in this kind of society. You got to know who you're hooked up with. And what we call these is patron-client networks. So we call these, you know, paternal societies in which political leaders possess economic privileges. And those economic privileges are connected in networks in which violence potential is embedded.
The Godfather.
Italy, yeah. Right, yeah. Italy now, southern, particularly southern Italy. I don't know if any. Ingrid and I have been talking about, she's done stuff on capital punishment, about gangs. You know, gangs at their lower end are bands. 25 people, you got to know who you trust. You don't trust people you don't know, and you shoot them. That's what life in Washington, D.C. is like. It's not like that for me, because the gangs in Washington, D.C. don't come to my neighborhood, but in their neighborhoods, they have problems. And what do we call criminals when they go from bands to limited access orders? We call this organized crime. Why? You got the Godfather. You got some powerful individuals. You have lawyers. You have the guys that go around and pick up the money and the enforcers, right? And they form a coalition of interests that are stable, but, you know, when the Godfather dies, you know, when Marlon Brando kicks the bucket, all hell breaks loose. Because who the powerful individuals are really matter. Now, in most societies in the world today are still natural states. There's still societies in which politics manipulates economics as a way to solve the problem of violence. The very interesting, 2 years ago, I said this at the end of the week, I work at the World Bank. I mean, I go down there and consult, and you know, some people think the World Bank is evil incarnate. It looks just like Holden Village. And I got to tell you, it's like there's posters on the wall for all these green things and all these social causes. And everybody who works at the World Bank wants to solve world poverty. That's what they're there for. It's called the International Bank of Reconstruction and Development. That's its formal name. So we were there in May. The bank is actually supporting some of this research. I tend to think of this like this, that is, I'm mostly interested in the historical aspects of it, which I'll be talking about a lot tomorrow. But then there's also the contemporary aspect of how development works. So we're trying to get the bank to fund case studies of applying this natural state framework to modern economic development problems. And we had a guy from Kenya who last May said, I haven't got to the next stage, which is open access to the science societies we live in. He said, Kenya's an open access society. We're like, well, because Kenya has a constitution. It has elections. It has democracy. It's got some relative stability. It's got some fairly rapid economic growth over the 90s and the aughts of the 20th century. I mean, not 21st century. And we did not want this to happen in February, but they had a disputed election, and they got violent. I don't know if you know the story in Kenya, the opposition leader who lost the election is now the prime minister.
Right.
Okay, what they did is they amended their constitution, so now they have a president and a prime minister. Mark and Chris. Right? And because the guys associated with Mark could not be left out of the coalition, Nathan and Tom got brought in. They delayed the big sale of a telephone monopoly. Well, after they got the things worked out. And they changed their constitution like that. Why? Violence. The threat to everybody was so great of anarchy breaking out now that it didn't matter whether that constitution was going to be durable in a way that these were a set of rules that we could obey forever and ever. In fact, it was much more important to say we're gonna throw that constitution out and write a new one that will solve today's problem, because if we don't, I might be dead tomorrow.
Can't you say though that it was an open access society freshly laid over a much deeper structure of this limited access order?
No, probably not.
That's more durable?
Yeah. You could say that.
I mean, because that's what broke out. But
right.
They do have that other layer. It's just it's not worked itself very far into the
system.
Into the order in their everyday lives.
Yeah. No, that's a really good point. In fact, that's sort of the there's something called the Washington Consensus, which has kind of gotten out of favor lately. But the way we think about the problem of promoting economic development is largely that view that if we get the institutions right, you know, that some of this will trickle down through the society and change the way that the society works.
Except the tribal allegiances are thousands of years old.
Yeah, right. And they're all that kind of stuff. So did anybody come to Jordy's thing? No? Jordy's session yesterday? No. Did this asset-based community development?
Jordy.
Jordy, yeah, sorry. What did I say, Jordy?
Yeah.
That's from Star Trek. Jody's session yesterday talked about how when people go into these, you know, really low-income neighborhoods in the United States, that they actually start ticking off all the things that are wrong with them. What did you just do with tribes?
What did I do with tribes?
Yeah.
I said the allegiance is as deep and old.
Yeah. Is that a problem?
No. It's just true.
Yeah, it's just true. See, here's the problem. Yeah, you're absolutely right. It is just true. So the problem, when you think about how we think they should be fixed, or this notion that we put these institutions so they'll go down, is in a sense what Jody was saying about poor communities is that people come in and say, here's all the things that are wrong with you, and we're going to fix them. So we go to Kenya and say, this is a problem. This society is sick, and it needs medicine. And the medicine it needs is a constitution, property rights, democracy. That's USAID is a big government agency that exists to promote democracy around the world. Why have we invade Iraq? Promote democracy. You guys can all be against it,
but remember where you were, you know, 5 years ago. Is this a good thing, you know?
And most of Congress said, that's okay. Democrats from Wisconsin and Minnesota.
Right?
How do we think about that process? Can that work? Well, if in fact these societies are basically the same as our society, then yeah, that will work. But if they're not, if there's really something fundamentally different about the way this gets organized, then it probably won't work. And that's where this question of violence really comes in. Because is this how we solve the problem of violence in the United States?
No. We don't. How do we solve the problem of violence?
Lock people up.
We lock people up.
Policemen.
We have policemen. We, you know, Ingrid will talk about capital punishment. We have threats. Now, in America, we put a lot more people in jail and that sort of thing than other people do.
Well, it's about just the court system in general, not just jail.
That's right. We have a rule of law system. Okay. That we have a really powerful government. A really, really powerful government. And you're the most powerful nation on earth. We can blow the crap out of anybody. Okay. Are you worried your government's going to come to your house in the middle of the night and take you away? I'm not even vaguely worried about that. Are you worried about that your civil rights are in danger? I'm not. Hey, look, if I was a 16-year-old black kid in Anacostia in the District of Columbia, I wouldn't be worried about it, particularly if I was in one of these neighborhoods, because the police are going there are terrified of what's going to happen.
Okay,
so in a dying in Golden Valley, a lot different than Hennepin. Whoa! Anarchy! Gravity! So what happens in an open access society?
Is open access societies maintain a system in which
the violence is contained by a set of institutions, courts, police, military. I'm going to simplify this by saying, well, this is both courts and military. And who controls these guys? Politics. Right? And who controls the politicians?
Economics.
When I say economics, I do not mean making the most money. You want to help poor people? You help poor people? That's what you like to do. That's what you do. And guess what that is?
Economics.
You do the thing that you place the highest values on. Remember that business about how do we add up people's values? We want to do things relatively. Okay.
The rule here is that politics manipulates economic access. It creates economic privileges and uses those interests so created to stabilize the violent, to incentivize violent individuals to not be violent. Have you ever read the Federalist Papers? Federalist number 10? I mean, what's the big thing that the Founding Fathers are worried about? Factions. They're really, really terrified, and there's a wonderful historical literature about this, both in Britain and the United States and in France and the kind of Western political tradition. Chris and I were talking a little bit about this. This ties into the church, the whole notion of organizations of power within the European society, between the Pope and, Otto in the 13th century, things like that. That the one thing you really need to worry about is organized groups of factions. This is a system in which the political system literally organizes economic interests. In our system, we say, wait a minute, you can't do that. We all have rights to participate. And because we have rights to participate, we have competition. And if we have competition, what happens to rents? They disappear. Or they don't disappear. Bill Gates is a multi-billionaire because of the rents that he got from inventing the operating system first. But rents in a competitive environment tend to go down over time, so you can't use economic interest to solve the problem of violence directly like you can in a natural state. So you got a political system here. Actually, let's work down back from the end to the beginning. What limits violence is a series of laws that are backed by sanctions, and those sanctions are credibly backed by armed people, okay, that will enforce the laws. We tend to think about this happening to criminals, but of course it has all kinds of implications for rule of law, because some of this stuff is about contracts and agreements between individuals. Some of this, like this, is about charters for churches. The rule is you can have freedom of religion. What does that mean? It usually starts out being freedom of conscience. You could believe what you wanted to. But freedom of religion is not freedom of conscience. Freedom of religion is you can have a religion. You can have Bishop Chris. Oh, excuse me. No, I'm sorry. Here's the bishop. Here's the, the religious leaders. And in America, anybody can form a religion, as we know. They're all over the television. And in fact, they can have recourse to the rules and laws that are already in place to solve this problem of violence. Now, the problem is that you can't let these guys run the show. Because if you put the judges and the generals in charge, we're going to be back in this world right away. So we subject them to the control of the political system. But the politicians aren't trustworthy. You know that. Why do these guys run for office? Because they have whacked out psychology. They need to be loved. They need to be in charge. They're crazy. I don't trust them. Anybody who runs for president of the United States is certifiably nuts. Would you put yourself through that? Any of you? Would any of you put yourself through what Hillary or Obama or McCain or any of those people? No, you wouldn't. I mean, so when you see people like that, you go, wait a minute. They're running, but how do we control them? Well, we control them because we vote, right? Actually, we don't vote and approve everything they do, but our voting reflects our interests and our values and what we think is important. If the political system can manipulate our interests, then democracy doesn't work as a way to control the politicians, and then they can't credibly control the course of the military, and they can't be relied upon to stop violence. So the logic of an open access society like we live in probably about 25 in the world. They tend to be associated with nations because you've got to have really, really clear rules about how you use violence. And that means you have to have really clear rules about the institutions of government that enforce them. And that means you have to have really clear rules about how you choose people. And that means you have to have really clear rules about letting people pursue economic activity wherever they want. Now, I don't mean economic activity is narrow. I really mean this broader. People can have their own churches. They can have their own schools. They can have their own flower clubs. They can have their own book clubs. They can have soccer clubs. What did Kit tell us about China yesterday? How many organizations are there in China? The Communist Party is threatened by any organization which exists outside of its immediate framework.
So how does that fit into your hierarchy here?
Okay. What China?
Yeah.
Okay, what China does is that she was talking yesterday about the household production system, right, allowing farmers to market their own crops. And in the late 70s and early 80s, they went to something called township and village enterprises, which is the party would allow towns and provinces to keep some of their tax revenue. It used to be they collected all their money and it went to the center, went to Beijing, and then came back out just like with the priests.
Okay.
And what they said is you can keep it, you've got a minimum you need to contribute, then you can keep the rest. That's too simple, but the formula is more complicated than that. And so they started up businesses. So the early entrepreneurs in China were all members of the Communist Party. Okay, so the organizations that they created in the economy were in fact political organizations. And although China is now struggling with how to move out of that, right, how do they get rules which will allow economic competition? It's really hard to do that credibly because the government is so involved in stuff. You know, E-Trade wanted to get into China, tried to get in for years, they wouldn't let them in. Finally, it merged with a company that has 51% of the stock and it does not know a thing about the internet. But it's politically well connected.
Talking about eBay or
E-Trade?
E-Trade.
E-Trade,
yeah.
Oh, eBay. I mean eBay. I always say E-Trade. I get that wrong. But I mean eBay. So that.
Yeah.
We think about this set of problems as natural states. We can think about natural states are, you know, Tolstoy says about, you know, all happy families are the same and all unhappy families are different, right? That in fact, you know, all natural states, all developing societies are different. They have a different set of problems. They have different cultures. They have different institutions. They have different ways of working these kind of arrangements out. We can think about these societies that are what we would call fragile, which are societies where violence is endemic. It's really just right there. And in that kind of society, everything is part of the coalition. I mean, you read about these guys in, where are the diamonds?
Sierra Leone.
What? Sierra Leone, right? The places where the guys in charge are always in control of resources, right? And they think that's, you know, why they're there for 5 years and then they go? And the reason is that they can't work out a stable enough coalition, so they're using access to these economic resources directly to keep people in power. And those coalitions turn over really fast, and sometimes they break out in violence. Sierra Leone's not really had a good government for quite a while now. Okay, but when we see that, if we reverse it and we say, oh, it's because they have these corrupt leaders that they don't use the diamonds to make Sierra Leone wealthier. In fact, it may be the reverse, which is the fact that they're continually having to use access to the diamonds or the oil or the copper or the whatever, the bananas that you have, and these are put in the hands of political leaders is because that's the only possible way you can get these leaders to the table together. And that's a really fragile society. And the societies are really subject to change. You can think about, and now there's a continuum here, and I'm going to put it into three little boxes. China is what we would call a basic natural state. And that's where you can have organizations, but those organizations all have to be within the framework of the state. What's important about organizations? Actually, Jody was talking about this the other day. People are more productive if they can act in a coordinated manner. Right? We tend to think about organizations as if they're all voluntary at every moment. Now, how many of you are Lutheran pastors or married to one? Well, not so many today. This is good. Okay. If you were at the forum last night, we were talking about the roster. What's the roster do? There's actually formal relationships between people on the roster and the church. And those relationships are enforced by who? No, the government. You have contracts. Now, within the church, what we were talking about last night with Brent, is the church has a set of laws as an organization that it enforces and works on. And we think, wait, that's not really a law because that's up to the church. So can we all decide to change it? Yes, we can all decide to change it. Because the Lutheran Church, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, exists within the framework of America, which provides that group with a legal structure. And in the Roman Empire in the 4th century, under Constantine, the Roman Empire said, here's a set of rules that will apply to the church. And if you read the Justinian Legal Code, it's written after Augustine, the very first chapter is about here's the rules with respect to the church. The Christian church is the formal church of Rome. So in natural states, the most powerful source of rents is the coalition being willing to enforce relationships within organizations. And guess who gets to form organizations? These guys. You guys? No. China? Got to be connected to the state. Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, constitutionally elected, is effectively reducing all the opposition by consolidating all the organizations within the control of the state. A mature natural state is one in which organizations can be formed within the elites that are not directly related to the state. Britain, in 1550, a bunch of dukes and earls go to the crown and they get a charter to trade with Russia. And their company, called the Russia Company, has some autonomy, not a lot, it's still really closely connected into Britain, into the royal family. Where's the first permanent colony in America?
Alaska.
What? Virginia, Jamestown. And guess what? And the Virginia Company was chartered in 1606. It was a formal legal organization that was chartered to build a colony here in America. Now, in a natural state, organizations and access to organization and these rules are limited. And that turns out to be a crucial key limit. This is really important for Christianity because in the 4th century, 5th century, I'm going to get the date wrong, I didn't check my notes.
Constantine?
Yeah, when Constantine makes the Christian church the formal legal church of Rome, it has enormous organizational implications that reverberate down to today. So, in the Reformation, reformers stand up and say, anybody ought to be able to form a church who wants to, and that goes right against limited access. Last night we were talking about inclusion, which is very much about open access. So, tomorrow, I'm going to talk about how societies organize themselves. Not in this large, floating over the top sense of how you can manage the problem of violence by manipulating the economy and the polity. I'm going to talk really a lot about this transition between limited to open access societies by, in fact, allowing anybody who wants to form an organization. That's what we did tomorrow. Thank you.